I prepared one, and in the middle of the night last night, I thought of a way to make it better. So I got up this morning and changed it, and then forgot to take the flash drive out of the computer. So if you want to come see it, you can at some point in time. I went to high school with a young man who was blind. He was an amazing person, a very intelligent and very tenacious individual, and I learned a lot from him. We were in a class together our senior year, a Great Works class. It was an elective class, and there were only about 10 students in there. And every class period, basically, we'd have a reading assignment. Of course, either of his parents, but his parents kind of took turns reading his reading assignment to him. And the rest of us, you know, sometimes we read the reading assignment, and not always did we get that done. But our teacher, in order to kind of keep us on our toes, two or three times a week would do a pop quiz. And Martin had this little device, and I don't know what it is. Some of you may know. And he could actually write things by punching holes, kind of a reverse braille situation. But all of us learned that you could code the true-false questions by how many pops there were. Two was true, and three was false. And honestly, you didn't want to hear it. You really didn't. But you couldn't change the fact that you had put true and you heard pop, 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 and it was like, well, if Martin thinks it's false, you know. Finally, the teacher said, well, just do it the opposite, you know, so that the class won't figure it out. And you figured that out for a while. And ultimately, what they went to was just, she said, just do it whichever way you want. And I can tell from your answers which pattern that you were using that particular day. He spent his senior summer after his senior year in high school at OSU, literally counting steps so that he could get from where he was going to live to the various places on campus where he needed to be. He showed just he had a tremendous spirit, and it shone through in everything that he did. It's such a challenge to have a handicap of that particular type. And there may be people here who have relatives or friends, or maybe you've gone through periods of life where for a brief period of time you've suffered from that disability or something serious or something similar, and you can begin to understand what it was like to go without sight. Jesus, when he was here, encountered people without sight. We live in a wonderful world where medical science can correct vision. Many people here today, myself included, are using some kind of corrective lenses. We have to in order to read. And so we're blessed in our world. In Jesus' world, that didn't exist. And there were people there who didn't have any hope of being able to see. And Jesus encounters these people. And frequently, he does dramatic things by healing them. You may remember in Matthew chapter 11, verses 4 and 5, when John makes the inquiry, are you he or should we look for another? And Jesus says, you go back and tell them, what's the very first thing that he says? The blind receive sight. That's what we're doing. That's what we're accomplishing. It's a very critical kind of situation. The passage I'd like for us to look at today is from Mark chapter 10, verses 46 through 42. And I'd encourage you to turn there and we'll read that passage together. Then they came to Jericho as Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city. A blind man, Bartimaeus, which means son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. They're leaving town, and there's this guy by the side of the road named Bartimaeus. And I've mentioned before, and I think the more I think about it, the more likely it is that this was actually the case. He's known as the son of Timaeus. That's how they refer to him. Not by his own name, but by this reference. Oh, that's the son, this man, this blind man who begs. You know him. He's Timaeus' son. Doesn't even have a full identity on his own. But he knows one thing. He's heard about Jesus of Nazareth. And as this crowd goes by, I don't know if there's discussion or if somebody whispers to him. There's no way to know exactly what happened there. But through some capacity, he finds out that that's Jesus. And he is determined to get Jesus' attention. Many rebuked him and told him to be quiet. Shh! Hush! You're making a spectacle of yourself. You're going to embarrass the town. You're going to embarrass the community. But he shouted all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus stopped and said, call him. So they called to the blind man, cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you. Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and came to Jesus. And Jesus, as he sometimes does in these situations, will ask this pertinent question, what do you want me to do for you? The blind man said, Rabbi, I want to see. Not, do you think you could improve my vision just a little bit? Not, if you have the power, I'd like to be able to see. He believes that Jesus can do this. This is his once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And Jesus says, go, your faith has healed you. And immediately he received his sight and followed Jesus along the road. Certainly that makes a lot of sense. Numerous encounters where Jesus heals people. And we get the picture here of a man whose eyes are open so that he can clearly see the Messiah. And the interesting thing about that is there are all kinds of people around Jesus who have the ability to see, but they don't perceive the Messiah. Helen Keller said, the only thing worse than being blind is having sight but no vision. And really, that's just a restatement of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 13, verses 13. When he described the Jewish leadership, he said, though seeing, they do not see. Though hearing, they do not hear or understand. They had put up walls. They had seen Jesus through filters. And those filters didn't allow him to see Jesus clearly. And because they're so prejudiced in their view of him, they're not able to really perceive what it is that he has to share. And we can look at them and we can be critical of them. And we are critical of them. But the thing I'd like for us to think about this morning is, what about us? How clearly do we see Jesus? What are the filters that get in the way of our seeing Jesus as clearly as we ought to? You know, most of us are blessed to have had people in our lives who taught us stories about Jesus, who shared with us important information, and yet in that process, they share some of their bias. And every now and then, it's really important for us to step back and try to shear some of that away and say, I want to see the new picture. That's why it can be so useful to read through a gospel. Next year, I'm planning to preach through the book of Luke, not every Sunday, but through a number of Sundays, in an attempt to just re-examine this leader, this man that we attempt to copy our lives from. I thought of three filters that I'd like for us to think about this morning in terms of the kind of things that get in the way of our seeing Jesus fully and completely. And the first one that I thought of was tradition. You know, the Jewish leaders simply couldn't let go of their traditions. They had all kinds of reasons and motivations, but their tradition kept them from seeing Jesus clearly. I've mentioned before, there's not anything in the Gospels that ever indicates that any of the leaders or the scribes went to Jesus and asked him where he was born. They just assumed that he was from Nazareth. One question would have cleared that up. They didn't really want to have that information. Mark chapter 7, verses 8 and 9. Jesus says to them, you have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to human traditions. And he continued, you have a fine way of setting aside the commands of God in order to observe your own traditions. Only happened to them? You know, we could probably make a list a mile long of all the traditions that we have, all of the unwritten rules, all of the interpretations and the perceptions that you're required to kind of follow or factor in. And those things are very large distortions in our understanding of who Jesus really is. Don't misunderstand, tradition can serve a useful purpose. There are things that it simplifies life. Well, we know the certain way that we're going to do things because there's a traditional way to do it. We create traditions that are linchpin kind of moments where we can keep memories and family stay together, rallied around tradition. So all tradition is not bad. But Jesus is saying to these people, your traditions have become more important than God's directive. You pay more attention to your tradition than you do the commands of God. And we have to constantly be wondering if that's a position that we have adopted as well. I was just thinking this morning, when I was a kid, we frequently would have, I think probably every Sunday, we had communion after the preaching. And at some point in time in my life, those two things got flipped. Now, I know why they did, but it's just interesting that that's just one tradition that we've kind of traded out. There's many, many out there that we could point to. We have to see Jesus. And every time we look at a passage, no matter where it is, if it's a passage that tells us about our Lord, we have to see it in the context of his mission, of his message, and of his example. It's not separate from that. It's wrapped up in that. And if we can't free ourselves of our prejudices going into any verse, then we come away with seeing somebody different than Jesus. Seeing him and knowing him, recognizing him is the most critical thing that we do. And any filter that stands in the way, particularly the filter of tradition, can be very destructive to us. The second filter that sometimes gets in the way is logic. Well, you know, that just doesn't make sense. Just isn't logical. Jesus tells his disciples in Matthew chapter 16 that he's going to die. And what does Peter say? Never, Lord. This shall never happen to you. And what's Jesus' response to that? Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm glad to know that somebody's got my back. Your support is encouraging. Not somebody says it all, as you know. Get behind me, Satan. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. You're looking at this as a human being. And I'm looking at this from a heavenly spiritual standpoint. When he's about to feed the 5,000, Philip will say to Jesus in John chapter 14, Lord, show us the Father, and that'll be enough for us. And you get the idea that Philip is just saying, could you just kind of peel back the sky just a bit? And all we have to do is glance up there. It won't take but just a second. If we could just see God in his heavenly throne, then all of this would be cleared up for us forever. Makes sense. Jesus answers, don't you know me, Philip? Even after I've been among you for such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Where does faith fit into that process? Jesus doesn't make sense because he's bigger than logic. Why did he heal the blind man in the first place? That's not logical. It's to show that he has a power that's beyond this earthly power. We don't need a God that makes sense. We need a God who can create what we need in the moments that don't make sense. Because he has the power to do that. If we could figure it out ourselves, then we could do that. And oftentimes we try to. But the powerful thing, the important thing that God provides for us is that he has the power to go beyond the things that don't always seem logical. The last filter is the filter of fear. There's just so much fear out there. So many people playing on it. If you're afraid, then you're going to respond in a certain way. If you're afraid, then you're going to buy my product. And over, there are people who are constantly bombarding us with things to be fearful about because it's of a benefit to them in some particular way. Bartimaeus, the people try to make him fearful. No, hush. Don't say anything. He doesn't care. He's not afraid of the crowd. He's not afraid of Jesus. He wants to have that interaction. Think about all the times that Jesus said, "Don't be afraid." Matthew chapter 10, verse 31. When he's talking in the context of worry, "Don't be afraid. You're worth more than many sparrows." In Matthew 14, when he's walking on the water, and the disciples see him coming, and they're terrified by that. And he says, "Take courage. It's I. Don't be afraid." At the Transfiguration, and imagine for just a minute being at the Transfiguration and witnessing what those three disciples were able to witness. Jesus touched them and said, "Get up. Don't be afraid." When Jairus comes to Jesus, they're going back to take care of his little daughter, and the word comes that the daughter has died. Jesus says, "Don't be afraid. Just believe." And when he calls the disciples to be fishers of men, he says, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you're going to fish for people." And being going through the process of trying to convert other people can be a very frightful process. Over and over, Jesus says, "Don't be afraid." God doesn't want us to be afraid. He doesn't intend for us to be afraid. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. "The Spirit God gave us does not make us afraid. His Spirit is a source of power and love and self-control." In every situation in life, we're invited to see it through cautious eyes, through suspicious eyes, to look for the danger and to look for the potential harm. We've learned to do that because we've been reinforced negatively when we don't. And yet when God calls to us, he says, "Trust me, it's going to be okay. You don't have to be afraid. It may be frightening. It may be something that should create fear. It may be something that feels like it's overwhelming. It may even be something that takes your physical life. But you don't have to be afraid of it, because I've already taken care of it." Basically, our struggle always comes back to faith versus fear. Am I overwhelmed by fear? Or do I have the faith to counter that? Bartimaeus acts in faith, and because of that, he's rewarded. Filters exist all through our lives. And as we look at our Savior, and as we look at our relationship to God, every moment that we can pull those filters away gives us a clearer picture. One of the things that Terry and I really enjoyed about living in Houston was access to Galveston. And if you've ever been to Galveston, you know it's not the prettiest beach in the world, but it is a beach. And you can drive there, and you can actually go there on your day off and have a good time. One time we were going down, and there's that moment when you cross the causeway, and you can kind of see the island out there, and that dirty brown Gulf of Mexico, but it's, you know, it's a beach. We were going over the causeway, and Terry was driving, and I was saying, "Wow, look at the water. It's gorgeous. Look how blue it is. It looks like the Pacific." Terry looked over at me, and she said, "Take off your sunglasses." And I had on a pair of blue-tinted sunglasses, and it looked gorgeous. It really did. And that's what happens to us in life. We wind up looking through a lens that's filtered or colored. And it's so hard to remind ourselves, take off those glasses so you can see it clearly. Ephesians chapter 1, verse 18, Paul says, "I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened, in order that you may know the hope to which he has called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance in his holy people." I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened. This morning we offer an invitation, not a man-made invitation. It's an invitation from God. It's an invitation that may need to be applied in a personal way as you try to reduce filters. But if there's something that needs to be done in a public way, we'd be more than happy to assist you in that process. If you'd make that known while we stand and sing this song together.